Hi, this is James Devine, and I am an educator who has come out of the trenches. Listen in as my friend and colleague Dana Goodyear shares stories and tips from other educators who have come out of the trenches.
Welcome to the Out of the Trenches podcast. This is Dana Goodyear. Thanks for listening.
My next guest is Lois Elizabeth Letchford. Lois's dyslexia came to light at the age of 39 when she faced teaching her 7-year-old non-reading son, Nicholas. Examining her reading failure caused her to adapt and change lessons for her son. The results were dramatic. Lois qualified as a reading specialist to use her non-traditional background, multi-continental experience, and passion to assist other failing students. Her teaching and learning have equipped her with unique skill and perspective. As a teacher, she considers herself a literacy problem solver. Reversed, a memoir, is her first book. In this story, she details her dyslexia and the journey of her son's dramatic failure in first grade. She tells of the twists and turns that promoted her passion and her son's dramatic academic turnaround. Welcome to the podcast, Lois.
Thank you, Dana. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, tell me about a time when you were in the trenches and managed to crawl out. And I think it has to do with something I talked about in the bio.
Ooh. Yes. My son went to school in 1994 to go into grade one. Mm-hmm. And on day 6 of school, I said to the teacher, "How's he going?" And she threw up her hands and said, "Well, he's so far behind. I don't know how I'm going to teach him." And what I noticed that was my son wet his pants, bit his fingernails, and in school he stared into space every day. Mm-hmm. And that start of a year that I wish I could erase from mm-hmm. his mind. And once you start school like that, the statistics will tell you the prognosis of getting out of that is a very small, very slim. So that's being in the trenches, and how do you cope with that as a parent at the time, and kills me today. I sent my son to school every single day. I dressed him for school, and I took him to school every day. And the school said nothing.
Mm-hmm.
What I didn't know was the teacher shouted at him.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that's beyond belief. Mm-hmm. Why someone didn't put their hand up and say, "This is not acceptable." Why didn't they do that?
Mm-hmm.
This child has a low IQ. He doesn't understand what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And sadly, nothing could be further from the truth.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that was the start. And then he gets tested at the end of 1994. And the test results showed, you know, he can read 10 words. Normally children are reading 1,000 words.
Mm-hmm.
He can read 10 words. He's got no strength and he's got a low IQ.
Mm-hmm.
And the lady doing the testing said, "Well, I had to call his name 3 times before he spoke to me."
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And she didn't recognize, I didn't have this child's attention. And that basically he'd shut down. And my son Nicholas is very good at shutting down.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that was the start of it.
And you worked through it, and you know, so you ended up being a stay-at-home mom at the time.
And
worked with him.
I was a stay-at-home mom at the time for many reasons. One was my husband and I had met and we'd married and then had these children, and he had completed his PhD in Oxford.
Okay.
And I had been there with him. So my career had been interrupted.
Okay.
And our eldest son was born in the UK. And then we returned to Australia for him to take up his job.
Mm-hmm.
So, and, you know, when you've got young children and you're not in the system, it's actually for parents, to me as a mother, it's mm-hmm. really challenging to find, to navigate your way through those waters
mm-hmm.
and find a job. Where's childcare? Where's the money coming from? And all of those unknown question. So I was a stay-at-home mom,
mm-hmm.
which turned out to be not an add-on benefit. It turned out to be essential.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then in 1995, my husband had study leave. So we went away and he went back to his alma mater. He went back to Oxford for 6 months. Mm-hmm. We took the family with us. And I thought, I'm not going to send Nicholas to school. In fact, I asked Nicholas, do you want to go to school here? And this little boy's face just, the colour drained.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't deal with this. So I taught him at home.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I go prepared. I go with a series of books titled Success for All. And we failed.
Hmm.
He couldn't do it. And I'm no better than the classroom teacher. And it's isolated, it's words on a page, no pictures. Decode the word, code the sounds, put them into a word, read it. He couldn't do it. Hmm. You got to the end of the page and you start at the beginning and it's like there was nothing there.
Yeah.
And my mother-in-law was here with me, hearing me getting frustrated. She said, Lois, put away what's not working and make learning fun.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, I really needed that input. I needed another view on this. And her words made me really stop and, well, forget it, throw it out. And I asked the question, what can he do?
Mm-hmm.
He can read words and he can see patterns. He was very good at pattern recognition. What can I do? I can write little poems.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote a little poem. I read it to him. He engaged in it.
Mm-hmm.
We had fun with it. We found the rhyming words. We made sense of it. We illustrated it. And the transformation in my classroom, our classroom, was amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And because one thing worked, you do it again and again and again. Mm-hmm. And every day, Nicholas became more and more excited. He was relaxed. His shoulders aren't near his. When we were doing the book, he's up here and trying so
mm-hmm. hard.
And now the shoulders are down. He's laughing. We're having fun. Every day, a new poem. Every day, new learning.
Mm-hmm.
And one person spoke to me when I was in Oxford and she gave me a series of books called Hear It, See It, Say It, Do It to help him learn to decode. They were phenomenal because we did the consonant digraphs, the TH, the CH and the SH with one short vowel mm-hmm. or with short vowel. And we learned these words. They made sense. And then I wrote poems with them too or whatever I did. But it all made sense. And the poetry and the decoding worked together and it just kept getting better and better and better and better. And you come up with 00
mm-hmm.
as in Cook, Look and Book. And I wrote a poem about Captain Cook, mm-hmm. the last of the great explorers. And Nicholas said to me, and who came before Captain Cook?
Mm.
And I said, that's Christopher Columbus. Uh-huh. That's an easy one. And he said, and who came before Columbus? His question floored me, and I did not know who came before Columbus because I'd not even thought about that. When you know something, you think you know it.
Mm-hmm.
And this takes this outsider to come in and say, well, what else happened? And it showed his logic and a logical brain, which I obviously don't have.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And because we're in Oxford, we're seeing these things and we could find the map. I went to Nicholas and I went to the Bodleian Library and said, where will we see a Ptolemy map? It's got to be here somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And the lady reaches down behind the counter, picks up a book, plops it on the table and says, this is the latest book of Ptolemy maps. That'll be £5, please.
Mm.
And Nicholas was over the moon, drooling over it, and we're experiencing so much of the world, you know, by visiting museums. And you walk around Oxford, I don't know if you've ever been there, but there are plaques to scientists around the place or authors. And so Nicholas is starting to make connections that you don't normally see in the real world.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Learning is no longer just in the classroom, but across everything that we're doing in learning.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And my husband's phenomenal because he joins us on this search of maps and he would explain much more of the mapping than I could explain about the latitude and the longitude and how they were changing. And we ended up buying a book of the changing map of the world that that I looked through. And here was the part. If I read anything to Nicholas, I lost him instantly. It didn't matter what level. You know, a kid's book, Nicholas couldn't take the information in. So then I had to read that information, put it into poetry format, share it with him. Now Nicholas and I can talk about it. And that the poem became our shared language. You're not only doing rhyming words, you're building up context and content, all within the place of a map. And he's seeing it. To me, you know, even today, I'm amazed at what we did and what he did. Anyway, in the trenches, we returned to Australia. I'm over the moon at what Nicholas has learnt for this 6 months. We speak to the lady who'd done the testing 12 months prior, and I said, Nicholas, learnt so much. Learning's been so exciting. She stood there, she put her hands on her hips, and she said, I've spoken to the reading teacher. I'm backwards. And in fact, he's the worst child I've seen in 20 years of teaching. I cannot respond when someone makes a statement like that. And I walked away. I went home and I thought about it for a long time. And I went back to school and I said to her, you know, you can call him whatever you like. If he is the worst child you've seen in 20 years of teaching, don't expect him to learn like everybody else. That was my first point. But I needed the background of success in England to be able to come back to her and say that. That was number one. And number two, the second thing happened, was the reading teacher sent Nicholas home with his sight words. Last year she'd sent him home with 20 sight words. Now it's 10. He knows 8 of the 10 words. He didn't know saw and he didn't know now. And for the word saw, she had sent him the sentences, I saw a cat climb up a tree and I saw a man rob a bank. And he said, I saw a cat, no. I was a cat, no. I saw add a cat, no. And I asked it and he handed it over. And it took me a long time to work out what was happening. But the teacher has given the abstract meaning of the word saw only. Nicholas is seeing the concrete meaning of the word saw. This is quite common for children on the autism spectrum and who struggle with reading. I saw a cat, I cut a cat in half. No, that didn't happen. I taught him by saying, what did we see in England? Did we take a saw with us when we saw these things? No, of course we didn't. We looked at it. And so it took me an hour of talking at that time for Nicholas to really understand what was going on. Fine. I go back and do my studies to become a reading specialist because I'm now feeling really empowered. You know, he's the worst kid ever, to see this dramatic problem. One of the papers, the academic papers I'm required to read, was titled Beyond the Deficit Theory, written by Professor Brian Tamborn. And in it, it said, when children fail to learn to read, the first thing we do is blame the child. And we look at their home background, look at their IQ, look at this. And that's exactly what had happened with Nicholas. They gave him the label, the worst child you've seen in 20 years of teaching. And they fail to look at how we were teaching the words. Why do children fail to learn to read? We give inadequate demonstrations. I saw a cat climb up a tree is an inadequate demonstration. And it's a demonstration he cannot engage with. Why did the child fail to learn to read? So now I really feel empowered. And that set the scene for me to take on other children who had failed in reading. What do I have to do to teach this child to read? That's my story. And that's my book Reversed, was about what else did I do to make sure that Nicholas was engaged in reading and writing, loving it, with a passion for learning, and moving on.
Well, at that age, when he was 7, would you have ever imagined he could or would achieve his PhD? Because now he has a PhD.
You're right. I could never have imagined. Nicholas has the acceptable label of speech language impaired mm-hmm. or day developmental language disorder.
Mm-hmm.
Nicholas had ear infections from the ages of 8 to 18 months.
Mm-hmm.
Ear infections impact the brain growth and brain development.
Mm-hmm.
And they require input. And if the brain doesn't get that input, and particularly the input of language, the brain does not develop within the normal range.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happened to him. The time in Oxford allowed me this opportunity to explore everything, and it was transformative.
Mm-hmm.
You know, transformative in a way that I did not expect, because Nicholas also has spatial awareness that places him on the 99th percentile.
Okay.
Something, and when you're teaching children to read, what do you care about? You care about phonemic awareness.
Mm-hmm.
Phonemic awareness, even today, places him in the bottom 5%. Where's his strength? His strength is mapping.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got this enormous discrepancy between what he can do and what he can't do. So, no, I never imagined that he was capable of that, of getting a PhD. I remember thinking he doesn't have a low IQ.
Mm-hmm.
And that was huge to say, he doesn't have a low IQ, and to see beyond that. And when he was 11 or 12 and he's building with Kinects and he's making these phenomenal creations, he also has a father who's an engineer.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And his first creation with Kinects was good. It was wobbly, a little, it wasn't perfect. Dad, an engineer, comes along and said, Nick, you've got to do this, this, this. And it went from being average to spectacular.
Mm-hmm.
And father is modeling, this is what you have to do
mm-hmm.
with buildings. And that, you know, that component still blows me away, because the other thing that happened is with Kinects, Nicholas is in school doing Kinects. He's coming home and he's building with this stuff and applying all his mathematical knowledge.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's so inspiring to see kind of how just that story from that age 6 and 7 and your time in Oxford and exploring how he learned better was able to set you on that course and, you know, explore, you know, have how he could be successful and how you could be a reading specialist to help others. And so after he was, you know, in school and, you know, succeeding, so you discovered as well that you're dyslexic. So tell me how that came about.
I'm in Oxford. I'm reading, uh-huh. reading everything I can about dyslexia or, you know, learning disabilities.
Yeah.
I'll tell you a funny story. And in one little book, they had a list of 20 symptoms of dyslexia that you might see.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I had 18 of the 20. I had a really good measure. My younger sister, she's 2 years younger than me, was doing things before me.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember that, you know, tying her shoelaces, telling her time. She was reading before me. And I remember having a book of dyslexia on my bedside table in Oxford. I had it there for about a month before I realized that every single word on the front cover, dyslexia, was spelt differently.
Mm-hmm.
And I hadn't seen it. And I thought, you know, if it was spelt the same way every time, you'd have the Y in the same place.
Okay.
My visual discrimination is terrible. And we watched, something on Wild Animal Planet, David Attenborough, about the way deer see the world, you know, through a filter,
mm-hmm.
and they don't see the tigers or this, that, and the other, where they had. And that's what my vision is like. I cannot see things.
Mm-hmm.
And it drives me nuts. I was looking for a calendar the other day. It mm-hmm. took me fully 5 minutes to see it sitting in that spot.
Mm.
It impacts me when I write something. I can't tell you if I've written in twice or if I've written of instead of for mm-hmm. or from instead of for. I mean, it drives me nuts that I can't read what I have written accurately. I can read well, but to read my own writing, I read what's in my mind, not what's on the paper, and I can't read it.
So you kind of have to go back to the moment you were writing and remember what you were thinking about when you wrote that?
No, I have to use read, please. See it. It's crazy.
So you had your book published in 20.
This podcast is a proud member of the Teach Better Podcast Network. Better today, better tomorrow, and the podcast to get you there. Explore more podcasts at www.teachbetterpodcastnetwork.com. Now let's get back to the episode.
2018, reversed a memoir, and the research that you did for the book, how does that connect to your work? Talk to me a little bit about some of the research just kind of during your career and how that helped in your teaching as a reading specialist.
Once I, taught Nicholas and I went back to the academic literature, I was shocked the amount of information that was in the libraries in general. It doesn't fall under one category. It doesn't fall under one section in the library. I became an avid academic reader across the whole, the whole gambit of topics. And I ended up in a journal of memory and language, looking at, speech and language, memory and language, reading, learning disabilities across all of these fields. And what I learned is that reading research, they do this, they'll do an academic study. There are so many factors involved in that academic study that their results will only move the needle of reading research about a millimeter, maybe two. But it's impacting how does this study with this group of people at this age doing this particular thing, how does it impact what I do? That's what I took away. And with that, you have to do a lot of reading to build up your philosophy and what goes wrong, what do children need to do? There's no one study that says magic.
Yeah.
I think that's what I really took away from it. And just, again, the depth of reading I had to do to come up with this is what goes wrong. These are the people I'm talking about. Yeah, it was quite amazing, actually, and I still enjoy a lot of academic reading, doing it. What have I said? What's exciting?
Well, you also had your first academic paper published in The Reading Teacher in June. So tell me a little bit about that.
I know I have a lot of knowledge about the teaching of reading. I was privileged in Lubbock, Texas. My husband has moved around and our family's followed. I was privileged in Lubbock to become a district reading specialist. And that happened because I met a 13-year-old who was non-reading and spent 4 years in a phonics-only reading program. And with that, I taught him to read and I ended up working for the school district, teaching children just like him. So I'm specializing in teaching children who failed numerous reading programs for a long period of time. With that, I end up with specialized knowledge on teaching these children. Great. And now I'm old. So I've been doing this for a long time. And then I wrote my book and I thought I've got to get my knowledge out. But I know I've tried to write a couple of academic papers and they haven't been published, even with editorial help. The edits I made were not good enough or acceptable enough. So I thought, what do I do? And I reached out to Professor Tim Rosinski, who's well known in the field. And I'd read numerous papers of his and said, I've got this knowledge. I don't know what to do. I can't publish it on my own. And he said, I'll help you. As long as you go first author, I said, not a problem. And I sent this paper to him and it's on pronoun resolution. Now, pronouns, those little words, he, she, them, it, they, that when you look at them, they're very easy to decode, but the meaning of these words varies according to context. Mm-hmm. I wrote the paper and sent it to him, and he said, this is worthy of the reading teacher. And it's the word it that I particularly looked at, because I use a book called The Story of the Little Mole Who Knew It Was None of His Business. Mm-hmm. Many of my students, once I've read the book to them, you come back and say, what's the it? They look at me blankly. And these are children who are 14 and 15 and 16. Now, why do they look at you blankly? Because the word it has been taught, just learn it. Mm-hmm. Not where's the meaning in the sentence? And I actually had one student throw a temper tantrum. How am I supposed to know the meaning of the word it? Mm-hmm. They were stamping around. I said, calm down, that's all right, that's all right. And that's the paper that was published this year, you know, with Professor Brzezinski. I mean, for him, I'm incredibly thankful. And he suggested I write, I've sent something else to him, put that in another journal article. So I just keep writing, and I have to reach out to people because I cannot do it on my own. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I have the knowledge to do a PhD. I'm too old and my writing's not good enough. Mm-hmm. Then it becomes too challenging and not worth it. So I just keep talking to people like you.
Yeah, well, you know, it's great that you're getting the word out through the podcast medium and also through the help of Professor Brzezinski and getting your, you know, he's inviting you to write other articles for the reading teacher and, you know, sharing your knowledge. That's the most important part, because people are always looking for just new innovations and, you know, understanding of the brain, and you have all this experience. So let's shift a little bit and talk about mindset and why mindset is so powerful.
When Nicholas was in first grade, mm-hmm. and what did people see? What did teachers see? A dumb kid. That's all they mm-hmm. saw. Mm-hmm. Can't do anything. Destined for a life of living at home, unable to do it. Okay, I taught him to read. I could see a different child. In 1999, our family moved from Brisbane, Australia to Lubbock, Texas. Mm-hmm. In 1999, Nicholas was in fifth grade. He's reading on a third grade reading level, and everyone is happy. Mm-hmm. Why? Because he's exceeded expectations. Mm-hmm. He's reading 20 minutes a night. We didn't think he would read or write. He's writing. Third grade level also. So what? We moved to Lubbock, Texas. In Lubbock, Texas, for multiple reasons, Nicholas goes from the bottom to the top. Hmm. 7 years that we were there. Significantly, the first was he lost his label of learning disabled child. Mm-hmm. He became a normal child within the classroom. A lot of things happened. A normal child. But we saw his discipline. Mm-hmm. We saw a child who can persevere way beyond normal. Reading in Australia, 20 minutes a night, everyone's happy. In Lubbock, Texas, Nicholas read for 2 hours a night, 5 and 6 and 7 nights a week. Wow. You're seeing a persistence that you'd never seen. Mm-hmm. If you're behind and you've got to get better, what have you got to do? You got to read, you got to write, mm-hmm. you've got to do the work. And also in Lubbock, if you know, you would know where Lubbock is, from Colorado.
Mm, yeah.
You'd travel for hours. Every time we got in the car to do a long distance drive, we listened to a book on CD.
Okay.
If you've got a language problem and you're behind, how do you get better? You've got to have the input. You know, if Nicholas is only reading 2 hours a night, and he's taking 7 nights to read one Goosebumps book, his growth is going to be minimal. Mm-hmm. How do you speed up that growth? By listening. And once you've listened and you've got the story, then you can start to read it. And then your speed increases. I mean, the whole thing, everything that happened in Lubbock blew me away. We didn't know what to expect. As my husband often says, it's an experiment you cannot repeat. Mm-hmm. But Nicholas flew in that town. And you know, he complains about Lubbock, and I say, Nicholas, you can't do that. you really did so well, and it really laid the foundations for you to do your PhD. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So the mindset shift from a learning disabled child to a normal child was huge. Mm-hmm. And he can do it. And the school set up the system, read. Mm-hmm. And he that read, yes, don't stop reading. Transformative.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Transformative.
You also talked a little bit about Dr. Mary Helen Immortio Yang and the brain research she does and the power of emotions and learning.
This was fascinating. And Nicholas received his PhD from Oxford in applied mathematics in 2018. Mm-hmm. He's confident. He's articulate. He's still slow with his thinking. But, you know, he's written a whole thesis. He's been mm-hmm. successful in reading and writing and in school now for many years. And I said to him, Nicholas, tell me what happened in first grade. My thinking, you know, it's all over. You'll be fine. He'll be able to tell me. My son sat with me on the lounge and he cried. And his tongue went round and round in his mouth and he couldn't say a thing. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And for the first time, I'm acknowledging that when he was in school, he was traumatized and it's something we had never dealt with. And we, in fact, we had ignored it. Mary Helen's work talks about how children need emotionally safe spaces to learn. Mm-hmm. And that's what I provided in Oxford. It wasn't the kiddies learning letters and sounds. We were having fun with learning.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he said, you know, and then I switched. I can't deal with first grade. I switched. Tell me what happened in Oxford. And it was like his brain switched. Instead of crying, he's laughing. Within the space of minutes, he's laughing. And he said, I remember you wrote all the poems. And he named the poems I wrote 20 plus years ago.
Wow.
And he said, and the mapping taught me to love learning and I never want to stop learning, he said. Now, that's how powerful it was. And then he started to giggle. It was a little seven-year-old giggle. And he said, and you wrote a poem about a witch's spell. I said, I did, Nicholas. It was terrible. But he wrote the ingredients to the witch's, and it was so funny. I don't remember what they were, but it was just so funny for a seven-year-old. And here's where Mary Helen's work comes in, is that in my book, it reversed. I ignored this poem. There's no witch's spell. There's nothing about that poem. Because I deemed my poem unworthy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Rhymes were not good. The whole poem, from my point of view, was to learn the words spit, spot, spell, spin, spun. And from that, he wrote these crazy things. Alien eyeball smashed with a hammer. Bird poo, three drops, half a bottle of magic potion and lizard's tails. I mean, you know, it's just kid stuff. And when people would come to the door, he would run to the room, grab this book, open it to this page and say, read this, and laugh. And the more people squirmed, the more he laughed. And that's what he remembers. Mm-hmm. So I not only created a safe space, but a one where he knew that all of this stuff was just so much fun. Mm-hmm. And that's when the learning happens. We think teaching of reading is about the learning of letters and sounds,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
only the learning of letters. We forget all of these other components that impact whether a child learns and remembers. And Mary Helen Immortio Yang has the saying about memory that emotional safety is attached to memory and it's not an optional extra. When we are happy, it allows us to access our memory. And that's what I did with Nicholas.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Now, and then you can recall the words. You can recall all those funny words. But the overriding memory is of the feeling from that classroom. It was so much fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you don't.
No, No, it's so inspiring to hear that he remembers that 20 years later, like how he felt when he read those poems, right? And the details.
It, to me, it was a shock. Mm-hmm. And I think for the first time, you know, I'm looking at my son as an adult, a competent adult, and you're looking back on what you did 20 years later, and it comes back as a totally different ball game. It was so transformative. You know, and then he ended up doing his PhD in Oxford. So Oxford became such an important place to him. Mm-hmm. But the emotion of it all, you know, this is fun. This is worth my time. This is worth my effort. They once said to me, Nicholas had no memory for words. Well, you know, his memory was amazing. Once you got rid of the pain, then you tap into me. He remembers and knows things that I've never known. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So teachers, no, come on. Emotion is really important. And I do have a YouTube channel after that. Mm-hmm. Because Nicholas had been struggling so much with it, I started a series of When Learning is Trauma, and I met with another lady whose sons have struggled with dyslexia, and she's a mental health nurse, and we started the YouTube channel titled YouTube series When Learning is Trauma. Mm-hmm. And we've spoken to adults, we've spoken to nurses, and we're speaking to Dr. Mary Helen in October. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, about the impacts of when children struggle, the impact of them, or the impact of those situations on their memory, on their life. It's staggering. And, you know, a lot of children, a lot of adults will say, I got in trouble at school, and then I got home and I got in trouble at home.
Yeah.
And you've got compounding pain. Parents, give our children a break. And I think that's what I was getting out of this YouTube channel was relax. We've got to create safe environments. We've got to provide places where children know they are accepted and valued. And we've got to find ways around the problems that they face. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I'll definitely put the link to the YouTube channel in the show notes. Well, kind of tying into that advice, what advice would you have for parents whose children might be struggling in school in terms of either reading or math, you know, just reluctancy? It could have to do with kind of how they're being taught. But now that we're, you know, entering the new school year and there's students who might have been in the remote setting for a year and a half and they're going back into the building. And there's a lot of social emotional needs there.
That's the first thing we have to deal with before we deal with memory.
Yeah.
Memory and social emotional development are tied. Mm-hmm. I suppose I didn't know that, or I hadn't thought about it in that way, that the two are tied together and the brain isn't a separate lot of compartments, but it's interconnected. Mm-hmm. So the first thing we have to do is relax and let children be where they are and accept them for where they are and what they've got, mm-hmm. not try and impose. And let the learning go at their rate for a time. Mm-hmm. The other thing I learned, and this has been a more recent experience of mine, even though I've known it's happening, that learning does not always happen when you're with just pen and paper.
Yeah.
That the broader the experience, the better the child is. And that's what happened in Oxford. Our learning wasn't from 9 to 12 on Tuesday, Wednesday and Thursday. Mm-hmm. It slipped out of the classroom and went into the museums and into the map shops. And he watched TV on one occasion. And it was an educational channel. And he was just over, Mum, we've been here. Mum, you've got to come. You've got to see this. This, Mum. And he didn't even have the words today. This is so important. We've seen all. Just, we've seen it. You've got to come. Mm-hmm. And it sent us on another exploration. So let learning be a little bit wider than just this pen and paper stuff. And, you know, I've been teaching these children for a while now. And a little boy came to me with age 10 with a question and answer stuff on Mount Everest. Mm-hmm. Passage, questions, answer it. He had no clue. And there were about five ideas on it, that Mount Everest was in Nepal, the It's the highest mountain in the world. Hillary and Norgate climbed it. It was at the time of Queen Elizabeth's coronation and something else. And Edward Hillary went on to build schools there. So there's five ideas. The child could not identify where Nepal or Mount Everest were on a map. Mm-hmm. Number one, if you can't get number one, forget the rest. Where do I fit in this world? So there's got to be a globe that children can play with, not even a globe on the computer. Forget that. I think sometimes AI takes away from our learning. Mm-hmm. Rather than enhances it, because you write in, type in Nepal, Mount Everest, oh, and it spins around, boop, there it is. What thinking did you do? Mm-hmm. None. So the children have to do the thinking themselves. Learning happens up here, not because something is done in front of your face. Mm-hmm. And that little exercise on Mount Everest really made an impact, because the kids are answering, reading the passage, answering the questions. The teacher has ticked yes or no. And what have they learned? I got it right, I got it wrong. Can I find Mount Everest on the map? No, I can't, even though I got 100%. That sort of learning is irrelevant. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's not impactful. And what has the child taken away? I got it right or I got it wrong. What does it matter? And, you know, in a century where thinking is critical, we're doing everything that stops thinking.
Yeah, you're right. Like all these apps and everything, it, you know, takes away. And that's kind of ties into a question I have about teachers whose children might be behind in their reading. And that could be due to the fact that they do spend a lot of time on apps and iPads and things like that. So for teachers who, you know, have kids coming into a new grade level and see that some of these kids are struggling, what would you advise for them?
I want depth of knowledge.
Yeah.
I'm not interested in superficial knowledge. Mm-hmm. That's one. So read and reread and reread books that children love or you love. Turn those books into dramas. Mm-hmm. The acting out takes it from being something that happens on the paper to real world. Mm-hmm. It allows for adaptation and innovation on the text. It allows the child to think a little bit more deeply. So that repetition is critical, particularly in the early years. And you're also building vocabulary. That's the first. The depth of knowledge, reread books. The pronoun issue is critical. Some children don't struggle with it. Others do. Read the paper that I wrote in The Reading Teacher about pronouns, the words like he, she, and they. Show children how the written language works. So that means going through a book, rereading it, rewriting pronouns with its actual name. Mm-hmm. Or what its reference. Show them how it works, and you will impact every single child in that classroom. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Yeah, because sometimes those, when the words replacing other words like pronouns, they don't always understand what is that referring to. So break it down, like you said, get to the bottom of the grammatical structure.
And even a third grader, a good third grader, you can find a text that will help that, that will make them struggle. Mm-hmm. They won't get it. The thing about pronouns is when you're learning something in the beginning, the pronoun and its antecedent, the reference, are close together. Mm-hmm. As language becomes more challenging, the pronoun and the antecedents or its reference get further and further apart. Mm-hmm. Taking in, you need more brain power, more language, more thinking. And I think the message I want to get across to teachers is that reading is thinking. Mm-hmm. Reading is not about decoding. You need to decode to think. Mm-hmm. But reading is thinking. So you want kids thinking all the time when they are reading. Mm-hmm. How can we encourage thinking in the classroom? Mm-hmm. Reward thinking, not just the reading of words. Mm-hmm. So when you've got to read a passage, let's read it and work on it and get the comprehension, the depth of knowledge before we go to that answering of questions. Mm-hmm. Does that help?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. Well, I wanted to ask you what your teaching philosophy is. You said it's on your email signature. You sum it up in one sentence.
Learning and learning problems dwell in activities and cultural practices and not in the heads of individuals. It's mostly right that learning and learning problems dwell in activities and cultural practices. The heads of individuals, if you realize that people like my son Nicholas or kids on the autism spectrum think concretely, It helps us with our teaching. Are they seeing the concrete? Are they seeing the abstract? What do I have to do to help them go from concrete to abstract? I think that's, I love that philosophy. That comes from Professor Kurt Dudley Marling. You know, he's, I can't even remember the name, social psychologist, I think is the word they use for him and for their work. But it's up to us as teachers to change the teaching so we engage more children to read, basically.
Well, out of everything we talked about today on the podcast, what's one thing you'd like listeners to remember?
When children struggle, instead of seeing them as, well, just a dumb kid who can't do anything, let's see them as future rocket scientists. And you never know what we can produce.
That's so great. Where can people connect with you and find you online?
I have my website, which is www.loisletchford.com. I'm on Twitter, I'm on LinkedIn, and I'm on Facebook some of the time. I'm getting really tired of this social media.
Yeah. Yeah, you get dragged into reading other things as well, right?
And it's just overpowering. And on my YouTube channel. And we had a book trailer done the day Nicholas graduated with his PhD. That is worth seeing. That's worth watching. Moves people to tears, even me.
Great. I'll put that information in the show notes. Well, thank you so much for being on the Out of the Trenches podcast today. It was a pleasure talking with you and learning more about reading and how we can better help our readers.
We can. Thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be here. And let's do what we can to help more kids to read.
Check out the show notes on danagoodyear.com to learn more about this guest and links to their social media. Please subscribe, share, rate, and review wherever you download this podcast. Tell your friends and colleagues about it, and if this episode resonates especially with you, be sure to share it out on social media and tag me at Out of Trenches PC.